system holds that plants sit on the landscape and wait for water, wait for sun, wait for spring, wait for everything to fall into place before they take their cue to grow. If plants were indeed the passive agents that they were purported to be, water would run right through what was obviously a porous substrate and pool in the lowlands, and we'd have seen conspicuously more green down low. But what if it was the moss itself that was keeping the high ground so mushy, hanging on to water that would otherwise have run down the hill, spreading the wet for its own purposes? What if this moss had moved into an area, deemed it not wet enough, and proceeded to change this high ground into the soggy mess it preferred, causing what was previously heterogeneous to evolve into a uniformly green expanse? What if the landscape wasn't setting the stage for plants, but the plants were setting their own stage? Green begetting green begetting green. What if it couldn't be stomped down, beaten back, or dried up? What if we were slipping, sliding, and stumbling across something stronger and steadier than ourselves? Carbon isotopes in leaves should give us water status. We can directly compare the values in the upland with the lowland moss, I said, summarizing my hypothesis, and started digging in my backpack for Atherton et al.'s Mosses and Liverworts of Britain and Ireland, an 800-page behemoth that characterizes and describes the salient characteristics of the approximately 800 species of British and Irish bryophytes. I opened it and began to read, hunched over so that my body blocked some of the spitting rain. The introduction told me that I would need to magnify each leaf, which was about as big as a fingernail clipping, by at least 10 and maybe 20 times in order to see the features that identify the different species. "We have magnifying glasses, right?" I asked Bill, and added, "Atherfuck says that mosses are best identified when wet." "Well, we should be okay on that one," said Bill as he wrung the water out of his fingerless gloves. "I am so sick of wasting money on fingered gloves," he had explained while purchasing them the year before at REI. We settled onto our knees and began to take inventory of the species near us. After 2 hours, we were pretty sure that we'd found Brachythecium, thanks to its furry, leggy appearance up close. Upon 20 times magnification, the fronds resemble Oscar the Grouch's pubic hair, Bill wrote in our field notes using his careful script. We were only partly convinced of its species. Rutabulum was the front runner. And so we settled upon Brachythecium Oscar pubes for the time being. Members of the Sphagnacea family were not hard to find, given the rich red pageantry of its incipient leaves, though for the life of us we couldn't place the species. After a long digression as to whether we should include the puffballs of Polytrichum commune, because they're so pretty, I argued scientifically, we agreed to limit ourselves to Brachythecium and Sphagnum, considering it likely that we would also find these two genera in the lowlands. Bill was writing everything down in detail. "How many of each?" he asked, mentally calculating how the contents of each vial would be conflated into 3 separate analyses on the mass spectrometer for carbon isotope composition. He answered his own question as he quickly recounted the number of vials that we had with us. "I guess no more than 150. Let's just sample until it gets dark and see what we get done," I said while carefully noting our exact location on the topographic map and verifying it against our GPS. We negotiated a labeling code that incorporated the date, site, species, number, and the collector responsible, and then took out our tweezers and got to work. Everything we've ever done and read tells us that the individual variability is high, so the more of these we can get home, the closer we'll get to measuring the site average, I mused. If there is such a thing as a site average isotope value. Bill hit upon the ultimate sticking point of our study. By the time we'd collected 20 sphagnum, we'd found our groove. First I proposed a tissue for collection, then Bill confirmed that it belonged to a distinct and identifiable individual. Then I photographed the plant against a scale card while Bill wrote down anything notable. Then I picked and placed the sample in a tube and capped it, and then Bill labeled it and set it down in order. At the end of this process, we retraced each step for accuracy, and I reread the code on the label while Bill verified it against its entry within the field notes. I believe that photographing each individual sample was over the top, but I let Bill have his way and gave thanks to the digital age that was saving us thousands of dollars compared with what we'd spent over the years in developing roll after roll of film, cataloging identical-looking leaves. We crouched in the wet mulch so close together that the tops of our heads touched now and again.
"I want you to know that I feel a lot better now," Bill said as he worked.
After taking a deep breath, he added,
"Which is surprising considering the large number of open sores covering my scalp."
We worked until our shadows grew long and the dusk began to fall. We gathered up the vials that we had filled and bundled them into Ziploc bags, carefully labeling them in batches. We drove back to the farm and peeled off the outer layers of our soggy clothes, and then we sat by the fire, steaming in our long underwear until late into the night. We repeated this collecting routine at 7 more sites, 4 located upland and 4 in the lowlands. When we packed up to leave the country, we had more than 1,000 hand-labeled vials, each containing a single leaf that had been identified, described, photographed, and cataloged.
"Ah, if it's moss use after, we'll get straight to making more and so bring you back,"
Billy told us as he sent us out at 4 in the morning with a big hug, and we got into the car and drove off toward our morning flight. Bill drove and I dozed fitfully against the window, nagged by guilt for failing to entertain him during the long, dark drive. Upon arriving in the car rental parking lot at the airport, we retrieved the broken side-view mirror from the trunk, taped the keys onto it, and heaved the whole thing into the after-hours key return. We got a bus to the terminal, checked our bags, printed our boarding passes, and headed through security. The moss samples were in our backpacks. We had learned long ago never to check samples unless it was absolutely unavoidable. However remote the possibility that an airline might lose our baggage, it was too much to risk where samples were concerned. When we placed our bags onto the X-ray conveyor belt, the glass vials tinkled. We walked shoeless and docile to the other side of the checkpoint, only to find a security agent waiting for us.
"Now then, you'll be having a permit for these."
She had opened our backpacks and was handling our samples as if they were wads of garbage that she had pulled out of a trash compactor.
"Oh, shit, permits,"
I thought. We didn't have one, and I wasn't entirely sure that we needed one just to get them to Norway. I should have looked it up before the trip, instead of worrying about Bill. I racked my brain for a believable lie or a funny story or anything that might get her to hand the samples back to us. Bill was always direct and honest when answering the questions posed by people in uniform, and it never failed to impress me. "No permits needed because they're not endangered plants. We're scientists. They're just for our collection," he explained calmly. The agent had opened one of our Ziploc bags and was roughly sifting through the vials with her hand. A couple of them bounced out of the bag and fell onto the ground. She pulled a single vial out of the bag, held it up to the light, and shook it. She unscrewed the top of the vial and turned it upside down. It was like watching someone shake a baby. I stretched out my arms, mutely hoping that I could appeal to her in terms of basic female sympathy, and she'd pass them back so that I could cradle them, settle them back into place, and shush them to sleep.
"Nope," she chirped. "Biological samples don't leave the country without a permit."
She scooped up the entire lot and chucked it into the refuse barrel with one motion. I looked at the pile of discarded items that had been abandoned at the last moment. There were bottles of drinking water and hairspray, Swiss Army knives and matches, an open container of applesauce, and a big pile of tiny glass bottles, each of them covered in meticulous handwriting and containing a speck of precious green. 60 hours of our lives were also buried in that pile, and possibly also the answer to an important scientific question, I thought. Bill pulled out his camera, leaned into the barrel, took a photo, and walked away. We trudged over to Bill's gate, walking on the backs of our shoes. In an hour he would be returning to the United States, and my flight wouldn't leave for Norway until later in the day. We sat down to wait, and Bill began sifting through his address book and scribbling down 1-800 numbers. He checked his watch and said, "I get to Newark at 9 a.m. East Coast time. I'll call the USDA when I touch down and see what we need to get a permit to bring plants out of Ireland." I sat stewing in defeat. The samples we've lost over not having permits, I thought. The time we've saved by not applying for them, I countered. When will I learn? I asked myself. Bill interrupted my internal dialogue by looking at me meaningfully and saying, "It'll never be really lost, you know. We wrote everything down. We'll start over. What do you think about it? We got a lot done on this trip." I nodded, and before long his zone was called to board. And for the second time that day, something was pulled away from me that I didn't want to let go of. I watched Bill's plane push back and taxi off. And I thought how the more important something was in my life, the more likely it was to go unsaid. Then I pulled out my vegetation map of southwestern Ireland, lined it up with the topographic map, and systematically planned out where we could find more moss. Bill would forever after refer to that trip as the wake, whereas I dubbed it the honeymoon, and we took to reenacting its climax at least once a year. Whenever we got a new recruit to the lab, his or her first task was to label empty vials, hundreds of them. We'd explain that this was a necessary preparation for a large-scale collection we had scheduled, and give directions for a long and complicated alphanumeric code, rich with Greek letters and non-sequential numbers, to be inscribed on each vial in pen, along with the order of production. After a day of steady labor on the part of the newbie, we'd hold a summit, and either Bill or I would play good cop, and the other would play bad cop. We traded it off. The meeting would start out with our asking the newbie how he or she liked the task, and whether this sort of work was tolerable. It would slowly morph into a discussion of the upcoming sample collection and the rationale behind its purpose. Little by little, bad cop would become more and more pessimistic as to whether the proposed collection would test the hypothesis after all. Good cop would resist this logic at first, urging bad cop to consider the fact that the newbie had put so many long hours into the preparation. Even so, bad cop just couldn't let go of the nagging realization that this approach wasn't going to yield an answer. And finally, good cop had no recourse but to agree that starting over was as unavoidable as it was necessary. At this point, bad cop soberly gathered up the vials and dumped them en masse into a lab waste receptacle. The cops exchanged a knowing look, and bad cop trudged off without satisfaction, leaving good cop to observe the newbie's reaction. Any sign that the newbie regarded his or her time as of any value whatsoever was a bad omen, and the loss of so many hours' work was a telling trial of this principle. As a corollary, any recognition of futility was perhaps worse. There are two ways to deal with a major setback. One is to pause, take a deep breath, clear your mind, and go home. distract yourself for the evening, and come back fresh the next day to start over. The other is to immediately resubmerge. Put your head under and dive to the bottom. Work an hour longer than you did last night, and stay in the moment of what went wrong. While the first way is a good path toward adequacy, it is the second way that leads to important discoveries. 1 year I played bad cop, but forgot my reading glasses, and so returned early to the melee. Our newbie, named Josh, was busily digging his vials out of the refuse bin, separating each one carefully from the used gloves and other trash. I asked him what he was doing, and he said, "I just feel bad that I wasted all these vials and stuff. I thought I could unscrew the caps and save them, and they could be extras or something." As he continued with his task, I caught Bill's eye and we smiled at each other, knowing that we'd identified yet another sure winner. Chapter 11. Like most people, my son has a particular tree that figures prominently in his childhood. It is a foxtail palm, Woodyetia bifurcata, that sways amiably in the wind through the endless months of Hawaiian summer. It stands just a few feet from our back door, and every afternoon, my son spends about 30 minutes hitting it as hard as he can with a baseball bat. He has done this for years, though not always with a bat. The scarring on the trunk starts down low and then proceeds upward, tracking my son's growth. When he was 4, he would use all his tiny strength to bring our sledgehammer against it over and over, while pretending to be Thor. This was followed by a period when an old golf club served, and when the dog quickly learned to avoid the general area. My son's recent baseball obsession has furnished an agreeable cover story. He now bashes the tree exactly 100 times a day in order to strengthen his swing. The wood-on-wood quality of this new approach represents an interesting parody from my perspective, and I freely admit that I don't feel inclined to intervene. He's not hurting the palm tree. If you compare its crown with the next one over, you'll see that they both have a similar amount of healthy green fronds at the top. It also flowers and bears fruit the same way that it always has, just as well as or better than any other palm tree in the neighborhood. My son has never shown the least interest in walloping any other living thing, and as it doesn't seem to be so much about hitting as it does about ritualistic noise-making, the beating of this living drum has become the rhythm of our lives. Every day I sit at our kitchen table and write while my son works over the palm tree. In 2008, we moved to Hawaii, lured not so much by the gorgeous weather and lush vegetation as by a promise, in writing, of 8.6 months of guaranteed salary per year for Bill, in perpetuity, from the University of Hawaii. That still leaves 14 weeks of his salary that I have to beg from government contracts each year, but hey, they wouldn't want me to get lazy or anything. Since moving to Hawaii, I've learned that palm trees are not really trees. They are something different. Inside their trunks you won't find hard wood growing outward, new tissue added ring by ring. Instead, you'll find a jumble of spongy tissue, scattered instead of arranged. This lack of conventional structure is what gives the palm its flexibility and makes it supremely adapted to my son's favorite hobby, as well as to the gentle island breezes that periodically coalesce into ruthless hurricanes. There are thousands of different palm species, and they all belong to the Ericaceae family. The Ericaceae are important because they were the first plant family to evolve as monocots about 100 million years ago. The first real leaf of a monocot is a single blade, not a double sprout as in the dicot plants that came before. My son's palm tree is much more closely related to the blades of grass within the lawn beneath it than it is to the monkey pod tree beside it. The very earliest monocots soon evolved into grasses, and grasslands eventually spread across the vast areas of the earth where it's just a little too wet to be a desert and still a little too dry to be a forest. With some breeding help from humans, grasses were evolved into grains. And today, just three monocot species, rice, corn, and wheat, provide the ultimate sustenance for 7 billion people. My son is not me. He is something different. He is naturally cheerful and confident, and he has inherited his father's emotional stability, whereas I tend toward nervousness and brooding. He views the world as a race car and assumes that he should be driving, while I have always focused upon not getting run over. Indeed, he is happy with what he is and does not question it. At least not yet, whereas I will forever be stuck in the in-between. I am neither short nor tall, and neither pretty nor plain. My hair was never quite blonde, nor was it brunette either, and lately it has become only sort of gray. Even my eyes are neither green nor brown. Everything about me is hazel. While I am too impulsive and aggressive to think of myself as a proper woman, I will also never fully shake this dull, false belief that I am something less than a man. Because we are so different, it took me a long time to figure out what my son had to do with me. I am still learning the answer. I had worked so hard for so many years trying to make my life into something that it was a surprise to see all the truly valuable pieces simply fall from the sky undeserved. I used to pray to be made stronger. Now I pray to be made grateful. Every kiss that I give my child heals one that I had ached for but was not given. Indeed, it has turned out to be the only thing that ever could. Before my son was born, I anguished over whether I would be able to love him. Now I worry that my love is too vast for him to understand. He needs to know a mother's love, and here I am, impotent to express the fullness of it. I realize now that my son was the end of a waiting that I didn't even know I was doing. That he was both impossible and inevitable. That I have been given one chance to be someone's mother. Yes, I am his mother. I can say that now. For only after I released myself from my own expectations of motherhood did I realize that they were something I could fulfill. Life is funny that way. While my son was growing inside me, I did the breathing for both of us. Now I go to his little school pageants, sit in the audience, and see only his face, though the stage is filled with children. I breathe in heavily after he sings each stanza, convinced that I can oxygenate his body from a distance just by the sheer force of my love. He is growing up, and I have to let him go a little more each day. I have learned that raising a child is essentially one long, slow agony of letting go. I am comforted by my suspicion that all my private maternal ecstasy is really nothing more than what every mother feels for her son. And for a daughter? I'd like to think that it's also felt for her, but this will not be mine to know. Being a daughter was so difficult for both my mother and me. Maybe our line needs to skip a generation in order to extinguish the cycle such that it cannot be repeated. So I've set my heart on a granddaughter. As always, my greed for love is unreasonably premature. Based on my projections, there's more than a small chance that I'll die before she's born, particularly if our line continues to skip or bifurcate. And perhaps this is the way that it was meant to be, For me, anyway. Nevertheless, here on this sunny day, I can't resist my temptation to put a message in a bottle. Somebody, remember. Somebody, someday, find my granddaughter and tell her. Tell her about the day that one of her grandmothers sat looking out of her kitchen window with a pen in her hand. Tell her that her grandmother didn't see the dirty dishes or the dust on the windowsill because she was busy deciding. Tell her that in the end, she decided to go ahead and love her granddaughter several decades too early. Tell her about the day that her grandmother sat in a sunbeam and dreamed of her to the soundtrack of a tree being flogged.
Chapter 12. As I walked into the laboratory, the look on Bill's face told me two things. First, that he'd been up all night, and second, that today was going to be a good day.
Where have you been? 7:30!
Bill's version of good morning has changed very little over the past 20 years. When he was living in his car, it was the suffocating heat of the Atlanta sunrise that drove him into the lab at this early hour. These days, if he's here before 10, it's because something happened last night that was too good to leave. And on that particular morning, he had called me.
"Sleep is for the weak,"
I barked out. "What's up?" "It's C6, he answered. "That little bastard is doing it again." He led me past the growth experiments, where 80 radish plants had been growing for 21 days under precisely controlled levels of light and moisture, within chambers of perfectly still air. One of the biggest ironies of C6 came from our assumption that we weren't going to see anything interesting. In fact, the experiment was designed to let us measure something we couldn't see. For any given plant, the part that can be seen is only about half of the whole organism. The roots that live under the soil have nothing in common with the green foliage that extends above the surface. They are as different as your heart is from your lungs, and are likewise adapted for two completely different purposes. Above-ground plant tissue works to capture light and gases from the atmosphere, which are converted to sugars within the leaves. Below-ground tissue strives to absorb water and the rich nutrients that are dissolved within this water, in order to further build sugars up into proteins. Green stem gracefully morphs into brown root at the soil's surface, and somewhere inside that interface, important decisions are made. If both ends of the plant succeed, there is then the question of what to do with that day's winnings. The making of sugars, starches, oils, and proteins is all possible, but which ones of these should be constructed? Upon gaining new resources, a plant may perform one of four actions. It will either grow, repair, defend, or reproduce itself. It can also delay its choice indefinitely by storing its earnings for remobilization later, and thereby put off the commitment implied by choosing one of the four. What controls a plant's decision as it chooses among these different possible scenarios? Many of the same things that control our decisions regarding what we do with new resources, it turns out. Our genes limit our possibilities. Our environment makes some courses of action wiser than others. Some of us are inherently conservative with our earnings. Some are prone to gambling. Even our fertility status might be considered when evaluating a new plan for investing. One atmospheric gas in particular, carbon dioxide, is a vital growth resource for plants. Due to the burning of fossil fuels, the level of carbon dioxide within the Earth's atmosphere has increased dramatically in the last 50-odd years, flooding the plant economy with fast cash and easy credit. Carbon dioxide is the currency of photosynthesis, and plants have now seen decades of an increasingly lavish excess of their most basic resource.
We were asking the following question with our radish experiments. What is this going to do to the balance of above ground versus below ground investment by crops around the world? Months before, Bill had attached his computer to an inexpensive video camera, and we had been using it to film a set of test plants while they were growing within the chamber. "Check this out," he told me when I arrived in response to his early morning wake-up call. The video was a time-lapse compilation of photos taken once every 20 seconds, condensing all of the previous day's growth into 4 minutes of video. The screen was dark and shadowy at first, indicating that the timed grow lights had not yet switched on. All at once, the image lit up and revealed 16 small potted plants, their stems and leaves limp and relaxed. Shortly into the film, the lights came on and all the plants jarred awake, raising their leaves up toward the light. One plant located near the edge of the chamber was conspicuous. It twisted and writhed, stretching both upward and outward, shoving the leaves of the adjacent plants out of the way, rudely slapping its broadest leaves down over the central stem of its neighbor. This plant was labeled C6 and had started life as a seed of exactly the same size and species as all of the other plants in the chamber. But somehow it acted differently from the others while it grew. And at that moment, while watching the video, we were forced to accept what we saw. For several nights now, we had moved C6 around, changed its neighbors, measured and compared it endlessly, and taken video after video, and the only thing different about C6 was the way it moved after sunrise. While the other plants stretched smoothly and gracefully toward the light, C6 jerked its smaller leaves feverishly, as if trying to pull itself free of the soil that was holding it. "I think it hates itself," said Bill. "I like the little guy. He's got balls," I offered. "Yeah, well, don't get attached," he advised. While Bill downloaded and reset the video camera in anticipation of another experiment, I rewatched the video 7 or 8 times, unable to resist the smackdown at about 2 minutes in, for which we had started to cheer. "I think he does a little fist pump right afterward," I observed. "You're nuts," Bill agreed. We heard the grow lights switch on behind us, signaling a new day within the chambers, and a vision of the untended paperwork festering on my desk appeared before me. "Damn it, we'll break him," I decided. "No water for C6, turn up the lights, and put him in the middle next to that really big one. Keep the video going." "Of course," agreed Bill. "It's really the only humane thing to do." By then, the students and postdocs had filtered in, making the whole place confused and busy. From the room behind us, we heard a loud clatter and someone hissed, "Oh, crap!" while Bill and I exchanged wry smiles. "This lab is a well-oiled machine," I announced. "You may as well take your weak ass home and get some sleep." "No," Bill said as he leaned back in his chair. "I want to see how this shit turns out." C6 was not part of a formal study, but it changed everything. I had journeyed over some kind of intellectual hill, and I could see new territory. We instinctively claimed it using a new language, one that flouted the old rules. Not content with referring to C6 as him, we gave him a real name, Twist and Shout, which later reverted to TSC6. We got used to greeting him first thing in the morning and took a kind of sick satisfaction in his ability to endure the torments to which we subjected him. He didn't live for all that long, eventually becoming one of the casualties of Bill's horrible migraine headaches. While Bill was curled up under his desk in the fetal position for 10 hours, holding his aching head, nothing got watered, fertilized, or filmed, and I tossed C6 unceremoniously into a waste bin. Our fascination with C6 was not a scientifically legitimate experiment. We never officially wrote it up for anything, and yet that small plant growing in a Dixie cup changed my thinking more than anything I had read within my dog-eared textbooks. I had to conclude that C6 did things. Not just because he was programmed to do so, but also for reasons known only to him. He could move his arm from one side of his body to the other. He just did it about 22,000 times slower than I could move mine. His clock and my own were forever out of sync, a simple fact that had placed an untraversable canyon between us. While it seemed that I experienced everything, he appeared to me to passively do nothing. Perhaps, however, to him I was just buzzing around as a blur, and like the electron within an atom, exhibited too much random motion to register as alive. I stood back and smiled at Bill and all the silly undergrads, and felt the joy that accompanies a new thought, as my mind picked up speed like a commuter finally passing a traffic bottleneck. My own spirit had been fed, and at the very least, the day's work ahead of me would be happier because of it. Perhaps that was enough of a scientific accomplishment in itself. A few hours later, I convinced Bill to break for lunch. I told him it would be my treat, but that I also had to stop by Whole Foods on an errand. "Me too," he answered and then explained. "I'm looking into homeopathic remedies for my hand." We got in my car and drove across the island. Having never actually been inside of a Whole Foods, Bill was immediately enthralled after we walked through the door. He went directly over to a plastic package that cost about $13 and contained 6 capers, each the size of a golf ball. He held it up toward me and asked, "Do rich people really eat these things?" "Absolutely," I answered without looking at what he was showing me. "They love nothing better." I was occupied in poring over the 7 different types of wheatgrass extract available. When I finally identified and selected the greenest one, I noticed that Bill had wandered off, but not before placing the capers inside my cart. I found him marveling at a refrigerated trough of soft French cheese, and all at once a plan presented itself. "Let's get all this stuff," I suggested. "Why the hell not?"
"You serious?"
Bill had narrowed his eyes dubiously, but his body was tensely hopeful.
"Sure,"
I announced. "Today we will eat like people with mutual funds." I often feel guilty that I make more money than Bill does, because our work feels like 2 halves of one thing. I also like to randomly buy things, and when he's around I can rationalize it as munificence instead of impulsiveness.
"Thank God they had all that crap next to the checkout,"
Bill observed while reading the label of an organic chocolate bar containing cold-pressed cocoa from the Dominican Republic and acai berries.
"I shudder to think how close I came to missing this thing,"
he said with his mouth full. Bill loaded our $200 lunch into my car by himself, shooing away any help from me. He had plans for the 4 real thick paper grocery bags, and had begun to hover guardedly over them. He got in on the passenger side, and as I started the engine, he mumbled,
"Oh, I sure hope this shit is fair trade,"
while preparing to unwrap a 2nd chocolate bar, this one flavored with rambutan. 2 hours later, we were sitting in the lab and eating Rockefeller Hot Pockets, which are composed of a slice of jamón ibérico, wrapped around a spoonful of sturgeon caviar, and microwaved for 10 seconds.
"Crap, I said, startled from checking my watch. I gotta go, but I'll be back tonight. Phil waved goodbye with a wedge of camembert.
See you later.
His words were muffled by the baguette that was stuffed in his mouth. I jumped into my car and raced over to pick my son up from his school, which was just letting out for the day. I traded him his swimsuit and towel for his backpack, and we drove directly to the beach, as was our habit. On the way, I asked him how the third grade was going, and he shrugged. We parked in our usual spot across from Kapi'olani Park. Walking across the park, we passed by clusters of great banyan trees, and I stood and waited while he swung from what looked like vines, but are actually the unanchored roots that grow streaming out of the branches. When we got to the beach, we laid our towels over our shoes and went straight into the ocean and played monk seals for a while, diving and rolling around in the shallows together. Afterward, we sat on the sand and I checked myself for bruises. Maybe monk seals are more rambunctious than the storybooks suggest, I mused while massaging my middle-aged neck. It's strange that such good swimmers feel the need to ride their parents for locomotion. My son was digging in the sand. Are there really animals in there so small that you can't see them? He asked, referring to the handfuls of wet sand that he was throwing back into the shallows. Absolutely, I affirmed. Tiny animals are everywhere. How many? He asked skeptically. Lots, I specified. Too many to ever count. He thought for a while, and then said, I told my teacher that the tiny animals find each other with magnets that are inside their bodies, and she said she didn't think so. I immediately overreacted and retorted defensively. Well, she's wrong. I know the person who discovered it. I was getting myself worked up. Like a judge trying to preempt an annoying trial lawyer, he changed the subject. Well, it doesn't matter anyway because I'm going to be a Major League Baseball player. I promise to come to every single one of your games. I asked my usual question. Can you get me free tickets? He paused for a while, thinking. Some of them. He finally agreed. It was getting toward 6 o'clock, so I stood up, shook out the towels, and gathered up our things, getting ready to leave. What's for dessert tonight? He asked me. Your Halloween candy, I replied, and added, duh. He smiled and punched me in the arm. We went home, and I made dinner while he wrestled with our dog, Coco, who is Reba's successor, and who, like her, is a Chesapeake Bay retriever. Reba lived to almost 15 years and was greatly mourned, but through Coco I have come to learn that the entire breed shares her best qualities. Industrious and indestructible, Coco never hesitates to go out into the rain and is constantly trying to figure out a way to be helpful toward whatever we are doing. She prefers lying on hard cement to lying in her bed, and she will go out back and munch on driveway gravel if she gets hungry before we remember to feed her. She will also run and hurl herself into a 7-foot-high crashing ocean wave if I throw a coconut beyond it and then command her to retrieve, which is what our family does on the weekends. When we travel, she goes and stays at Uncle Bill's house, where she deals severely with the rats that threaten his favorite mango tree. Clint came home from work just in time for us to eat dinner all together, and afterward we took Coco for a long walk around the neighborhood. Our son was successfully in bed at exactly 9 o'clock, but not before I handed him a small vial of wheatgrass juice while he prepared to brush his teeth. Drink this first, I commanded, if you dare, I added. His eyes widened. You did it, he said with awe, and then drank it down while wincing over its bitter taste.
For weeks he had been begging me to make a potion that would turn him into a tiger. "Make it in your lab," he had directed me. "Make it out of plants." As I tucked him into bed, he got that look that kids wear when there is something important that they want to tell you. "Me and Bill are going to put a basement on our treehouse," he told me. "How are you going to do that?" I asked, genuinely interested. "We're going to design it," he explained. "It will take a lot of designing. We're going to make a mock-up first." I pushed my luck. "Can I go inside when it's done?" "No," he refused, and then reconsidered. "Well, maybe after it's not new anymore." After a pause, he closed his eyes and asked, "Am I a tiger yet?" I looked him up and down slowly, and then answered, "No." "Why not?" he asked. "Because it takes a long time," I answered. "Why does it take a long time?" he pursued. "Why? I don't know," I admitted, then added, "It takes a long time to turn into what you're supposed to be." He looked at me as if he wanted to ask more questions, but he also understands that pretending that things are true is often more fun than knowing that they are false. "But it will work for sure, won't it?" he asked. "It will work," I confirmed. "It worked before." "On who?" he said, intrigued. "On a little mammal named Hadracodium," I explained. "He lived almost 200 million years ago, and he spent most of his time hiding from the dinosaurs, who would step on him if he didn't watch out. Do you remember the magnolia tree in front of the house where we lived when you were little?" I asked. "That tree out front was the great-great-great-great and more grandchild of the first flower, which looked like it. It was just born as a brand new kind of plant when Hadracodium was running around. One day he ate some leaves from it because his mom told him that it would make him as strong as a dinosaur. But it turned him into a tiger instead. It took 150 million years, and a lot of trial and error. But she finally did turn into a tiger." My son perked up. "She? You said it was a he. The tiger is a boy." "Why can't the tiger be a girl?" I asked. My son explained the obvious. "Because it's not." After a few seconds, he added, "Are you going to the lab tonight?" "Yes, but I'll be back before you wake up," I assured him. "Daddy is just across the hall, and Coco is watching you while you sleep. This house is full of people who love you," I chanted, our customary bedtime mantra. He turned to the wall, a signal that he's too sleepy for more talking. I went into the kitchen and made two cups of instant coffee. Looking at the clock, I figured I would get into the lab by 10:30. When I picked up my phone to text Bill that I was on my way, I saw that there were already two texts from him. The first read, "Bring Ipecac." And the second, sent about an hour later, said, "And more food." I brought the second cup of coffee to Clint and said, "I'm nearly off." We both knew that the pages of handwritten equations that he was busy deriving were thoroughly unintelligible to me. And so he laughed when I said, "Hey, let me know if I can help you with that, eh?" "Actually," he mentioned, "I would like to get your take on a figure that I made today." "It's great. I love it," I said without looking up from my purse as I was digging for my keys. "It's new. You haven't seen it yet," he emphasized. "And it's crap. The y-axis is way off," I said, waving one hand. He laughed again. "It's a map," I answered. "Then the colors are wrong. Babe, I gotta go botch my own science. No time to ruin yours." I added helplessly, "The monkey jungle never sleeps." "Well, thanks for the consult," he said as I kissed him. I went back into our son's room to check that he was sleeping. I kissed him on the forehead and smiled because he had already gotten to the age where he doesn't always let me kiss him when he is awake. I recited the Lord's Prayer, and my heart felt full. I petted Coco, who was lying at the foot of the bed, when I hugged her head and whispered, "Will you guard my baby?" She looked at me with the big, somber eyes of a Chesapeake who had answered that question once and for all years ago. I kissed my husband again, put on my backpack, and went outside to open the shed. I got out my bike and looked up through the warm, tropical sky into the terminal coldness of space and saw light that had been emitted years ago from unimaginably hot fires that were still burning on the other side of the galaxy. I put on my helmet and rode to the lab, ready to spend the rest of the night using the other half of my heart. Chapter 13. Often when dealing with plants, it is difficult to tell the end from the beginning. Rip almost any plant in half, and its roots can live on for years. The trunk of a felled tree will attempt to grow whole again year after year after year. Its inner trunk is lined with dormant buds, sometimes twice as many buds as are visible from the outside, ready to incite. Buds burst as stems, stems become twigs, lucky twigs become branches, good branches persist for decades, and eventually the canopy is as green as it ever was, perhaps all the more so because someone tried to cut it down. Unlike animals, which function as a single whole, plants are modular in construction, the whole strictly equivalent to the sum of its parts. A tree can shed and replace whole portions of itself, and is indeed compelled to do so repeatedly throughout the several centuries of its average lifespan. In the end, trees die because being alive has simply become too expensive for them. Whenever the sun is up, leaves are working to split water, add atmosphere, and then glue the whole mess into sugar that can be transported down into the stem, where it meets dilute nutrients that were laboriously pulled up by the roots. A plant can bundle all these treasures into new wood and use it to strengthen the trunk or branches. But the tree also has many other demands, replacing old leaves, making medicine against infection, pumping out flowers and seeds. These use the same raw materials. There are never enough to spare, and there is only so far out or down the tree can go in order to search for them. Eventually, it will require more nutrients to maintain the branches and roots that do not grow quite far out enough to capture those nutrients. Once it exceeds the limitations of its environment, it loses all. And this is why you must trim a tree periodically in order to preserve it. Because, as Marge Piercy first said, both life and love are like butter and do not keep. They both have to be made fresh every day. Chapter 14. There is something profoundly sad about the end of a plant growth experiment. We grow a lot of Arabidopsis thaliana, which is a modest little plant. Once it is fully grown, you can pick the whole thing up as a single handful. It's one of the very few plants for which scientists have decoded the entire genome, which means that if you unravel the DNA inside one cell of the plant and stretch it out, we can tell you the exact chemical formula of the 125 million proteins that, one after the other, make up the chain. Once unraveled from its tight snarl within a cell, this chain of proteins stretches almost 2 full inches. Every single cell in the plant has at least one snarl of these proteins, and scientists have worked out the chemical formula for the whole damn thing. I don't like to think about it, actually. It's just too much data. It overwhelms me. A scientist is supposed to feel overwhelmed at the beginning of her career, not the end. But the more I know, the more my legs buckle underneath me with the weight of all this information. For the first time in my life, I feel tired. I remember fondly the long weekends of years past when I could work steadily for 48 hours, when each new data point reinvigorated me and recharged my mind in stochastic bursts that culminated periodically into new ideas. I still generate ideas, but they are richer and deeper, and they come to me while I am sitting down. Such ideas are also much more likely to actually work. And so each morning, I pick up something green and look at it, and then I plant some more seeds. I do it because it is what I know how to do. Last spring, Bill and I were sifting through the aftermath of a big agricultural experiment up at the greenhouse. We had been growing sweet potatoes under the greenhouse gas levels predicted for the next several hundred years, the levels that we're likely to see if we, as a society, do nothing about carbon emissions. The potatoes grew bigger as carbon dioxide increased. This was not a surprise. We also saw that these big potatoes were less nutritious, much lower in protein content, no matter how much fertilizer we gave them. This was a bit of a surprise. It is also bad news, because the poorest and hungriest nations of the world rely on sweet potatoes for a significant amount of dietary protein. It looks as if the bigger potatoes of the future might feed more people while nourishing them less. I don't have an answer for that one. The harvest had taken place a few days before with a huge team of students working almost 3 days straight, all led by a fantastically strong and wise young man named Matt, who would graduate soon. During the course of the experiment, he had grown as well, coming into himself as a leader and an expert in a way that was beautiful to see. He could now stand up in front of 20 people in a scene of chaos, streamline each person toward one useful activity, and then provide non-stop advice and quality control for days. It was as if he had gone to war on those plants, and the odd leaf or root lying about the place was evidence of his victory. Bill and I had felt truly privileged to stand by, hands off as we must eventually be when a student nears graduation. But now it was all over, and everyone was home resting, except us. This is what it must feel like to visit your son's room after he leaves for college. The beginnings of his life left haphazardly behind, irrelevant to him but still precious to you. The air of the greenhouse was thick with the smell of potting soil. Matt had unearthed every potato from every plant and photographed, measured, and describe them each individually. The whole thing was a bit of a blur in the harsh light of day. I sensed that I needed to go home and get some rest, but then again, I supposed that a few more hours wouldn't kill me, and so I stayed. My phone buzzed, and I looked at the calendar, only to realize that I was about to miss the mammogram that was 3 years overdue, which I had already rescheduled once that semester. Oh, crap, I thought. Not again. The greenhouse door swung open and Bill came in.
We can cut out our own tumors, right?
I asked him.
I mean, we've got a box cutter around here somewhere, don't we?
Bill answered without missing a beat.
A drill would work better.
He reflected for a moment.
I think I've got a special tip for that, actually.
He was chewing hard on one end of a slice of cold, dry pizza that he'd found in one of the many boxes that had been ordered and discarded during the night. 20 years, I thought, and Bill wasn't any the worse for wear. Bill was thinking of something different. He looked at me and asked,
Good Lord, did you age 5 years while I was outside? And then added, you look like a fucking sea hag. You're fired, I told him. Go see the other sea hags down in HR.